Good to see everyone here this morning. I appreciated Gary's planning, getting to make announcements the very month that his grandchild was born. And it's very clear to me that the fact that this is his grandchild is really the important thing. And I would feel exactly the same if it was me in those shoes. Most of us are familiar with the name Asaph. He's identified in the Old Testament as a worship leader, a singer, in the time of David. In fact, as you read through the Psalms, you probably realize that Asaph wrote a number of the Psalms that are in our book of Psalms. And in fact, not too long ago, there were some comments made, specifically in the context of David's life, about Psalm 73. Appreciated Clark's reading of the first 17 verses of that psalm. And I want to focus, if you would, on verse 2. Asaph writes, "But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped." Why? You wouldn't expect that from one of the worship leaders, from one of those who are in front of God's people leading. But Asaph tells us in verse 3, "For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Can we turn that TV back there on, please? When you get a chance. "For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." So Asaph had looked around and he had seen the wicked prospering. And he concluded then in verse 13, "All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning." Things aren't going as well for me. And so maybe I just am trying to live righteously without any profit. You know, it's not really uncommon for individuals to have some questions about their convictions, just like Asaph writes about here in Psalm 73. Sometimes those doubts are triggered by peer pressure. Everybody else believes something different. And so now I begin to wonder if maybe I'm the one who's out of sync with the truth. Sometimes it's personal trauma. Things happen in our lives, maybe the death of a loved one or serious sickness, and we begin to question some of our own convictions, our own faith. Or it may simply be that as we look around in the religious world and we see that so many other religious people who study the Bible, at least ostensibly, come to different conclusions than we do. And that can make us look at our own conclusions and say, well, I wonder, why is it that so many others are not seeing it the way I see it? And so doubts are triggered by those kinds of things and other things as well. And sometimes those doubts tend to develop over an extended period of time. They don't happen in a week or a day, but maybe over years, slowly I just become less and less convicted about the things that I embraced, the truths that I embraced in the past. So this morning I want to talk to you about when doubt arises. I'm really persuaded, although I wouldn't say that it's a universal problem, but I would suggest to you that I think it's a fairly common problem among Christians that at some point we may question the validity of our convictions. Well, how do we deal with that? What kind of response do we make when that niggling doubt begins to worry us from time to time? Well, this morning I want to accomplish two things. I want to begin by suggesting that asking questions about what we believe is not a bad thing. And if you don't go away with any other idea than that, I think that's important. And secondly, I want to encourage us to respond to doubt properly. Because there's great risk here. Risk of the shipwreck of our faith, of falling away, of being lost eternally, if we allow our doubts to overcome us. When I was completing my bachelor's degree, and I completed it much later than many of you probably, I think it was in my senior year that I finally ended up taking a class entitled Philosophy of History. And at the particular university where I was going, it was a requirement for graduation of all students, all curricula, had to take that class, Philosophy of History. And as near as I could tell, it was basically an indoctrination class in which the professor basically denigrated Christianity and the Bible and encouraged people to think broadly, openly. In other words, he was encouraging pluralism. You shouldn't decide that what you think is truth when somebody else thinks something else is truth. It's all true. It's just what we look at it. Most of the students in the class that I was in would have been freshmen. I was somewhat older than those students, and through that semester, I became this professor's worst nightmare. As an older student, I was more willing to controvert things that he said that I thought were absolutely untrue. And it was a discussion-type class. He would ask for a response or sometimes permit it, and I would raise my hand. And it didn't take very long for him to realize that he didn't want to call on me. It almost got to be a joke. Well, it really was. By the end of the semester, the people that would sit around me in the class would giggle because I would have my hand up and he would not look at me. He would not acknowledge that my hand was up because he knew what was coming if he called on me. And I was respectful. I wasn't mean or sarcastic. I don't think you accomplish anything that way. But he didn't want to be opposed by anybody. He wanted people just to accept what he said. It was an indoctrination class. I think it's often during those college years where young people are influenced by atheistic educators in some cases, and they're often away from home, attending university, maybe in a different place, and so they have less parental influence upon them at those times. And they are encouraged in that kind of a class and in many other classes to throw off the traditional beliefs that they had previously embraced. Things like, there's a God who created the universe. Well, that's superstitious religious stuff. Or that the Bible is God's word written by human authors, guided by the Holy Spirit. Who believes that? And so college students are made fun of and they're ridiculed and they're basically treated like morons if they believe this kind of traditional swill. And if the faith of young people, their conviction, their belief in those kinds of truths is based on parental choice, well, that's what my parents believe. That's what I heard the whole time I was growing up. That's what everybody in my family believes. Or if it is by parental pressure, then this is the time when the tendency to begin to have doubts grows strong. And some of those young people will end up making shipwreck of their faith. I believe that there are others who question their convictions, not so much in a search for truth, but because their convictions have become inconvenient. And by that I simply mean that if they believe in a God who has expressed a moral standard that they don't really want to follow, then they'll find all kinds of reasons why you can't believe in that. And so they raise lots of questions, lots of doubts about their former faith because they want to be free of the moral restrictions that that faith carries. I think Paul maybe was talking about some of those people in Romans, the first chapter, when he talked about the depths to which Gentile society had sunk. And I call your attention to Romans 1, verses 21 through 23. Paul said, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. It's interesting that three times in that passage, if I recall correctly, the text says, and God therefore gave them over to. He allowed them to pursue what they wanted to pursue as they rejected the true God and began to worship false gods. Romans 1:28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done, but what they really wanted to do. And so the worship of false gods often involved gross immorality, because that's the path that people wanted to take. I want to say again to you this morning that asking questions, or even for that matter, having doubts about our faith, our convictions, that's not the problem. The real problem is when we don't seek answers to those doubts. The real problem is when we're not willing to accept reasonable or reasoned answers to those questions. Sometimes people don't want the answers, as I've suggested, because they don't really want to continue to have that faith. You ever had a splinter, a wood splinter in your finger or your foot, and you just couldn't seem to get it out? In many cases, unless there are extenuating circumstances, your body will take care of that. It'll absorb that. It'll basically kill that invader. It'll dissolve it. Or sometimes we're fortunate enough to pull the splinter out. My mom was an expert at that. You didn't want that to happen. Well, I won't go into all that. But you'd say, well, I've got a splinter. I'll get it out. No, it's okay. It's okay. I'll grit my teeth and suffer the pain. But I'll tell you what can happen with a splinter. Under some circumstances, it can fester. It can create infection, depending on the kind of splinter and where it's located and how big it is. And it can become a big problem. And doubt is like that. If it's not resolved, it really has a tendency to fester. And then it becomes a bigger problem and a bigger problem until sometimes it just basically kills the faith of the individual affected. So how should we deal with doubt? I want to suggest four things to you. And the first one is that biblical faith is based on indirect evidence and really particularly the testimony of witnesses. Unlike what is often said about faith, faith is not blind credulity. In other words, I just believe something because I want to believe it, because it's enjoyable to me, or I find it pleasing, or it's what I really want. Biblical faith is conviction that's based on indirect evidence. And I believe that's why, as you go through the sermons that are preached in the book of Acts, those that are recorded, you will find in those sermons specific mention of witness testimony, eyewitness testimony. It happens again and again. I've given you references. We'll not go through and read them, but I think you understand how important that would be for an apostle, or even the apostle Paul, later born out of due season as he describes himself, for them to say, Jesus was raised from the dead. He's the Son of God. We saw him raised from the dead. Eyewitness testimony. Because in many cases they were preaching to people who had not seen that with their own eyes, had not talked with Jesus or ate with him after his resurrection. The apostles said, we did. We saw him. We ate with him. And so they were witnesses of that. That's why John writes in his gospel, towards the end of the gospel, he says in verse 30 of chapter 20. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. Now listen to verse 31. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. You haven't seen Him change water into wine. You didn't see the multiplication of the loaves and fishes to feed 5,000. You didn't see the healing of the blind or the lame. But I'm writing these things as one who witnessed it so that you will believe. Faith based on testimony. Testimony is indirect evidence. Knowledge, by contrast, is based on empirical evidence or sensory evidence, as we typically would talk about. What we can ascertain by our own senses. I'm going to illustrate that by asking David Weatherford, who's hiding back in the corner of the auditorium there, what color this ball is.
It's definitely a blue ball.
David said, it's definitely a blue ball. Why do you say that?
I can see it.
So you can see it. The rest of you, do you believe it's a blue ball? You know it is, because you can see it for yourselves. Did you have to accept David's testimony on that? Not that I'm controverting your integrity or honesty, David. But did the rest of you have to depend on his testimony in order to decide that this is a blue ball? I have to tell you a short story. I know I'm running short on time this morning, but I have to tell you a short story. I was talking to Debbie about this illustration, and she said, yeah, but would everybody agree? We all have to agree that this is blue and not yet. Sometimes it doesn't pay to run your sermon by your wife. That's all I'm saying, okay? That's all I'm saying. So you know it's a blue ball because you can see it for yourself. No indirect evidence here. It's direct evidence. Now, I'm going to ask Ralph, if he will, to assist me in the next part of this illustration. I've got another ball in this box. And I'm going to ask Ralph, you can do it right here, Ralph. You don't have to come up to the pulpit. I'm going to ask Ralph to look at the ball inside the box. Nobody else gets to see it, just Ralph. And then I want Ralph to tell us what color the ball in the box is. Caleb, does your dad know the basic colors? 8 basic colors?
I hope so.
Good, good. Go ahead, Ralph. Yellow. What color?
Yellow is the color of the ball in the box.
Okay. Thank you, Ralph. Thank you. Yellow is the color of the ball in the box. How many of you know for certain what the color of this ball is? Really? Some of you say you do? You know for certainty? Did you see it? Nope. Ralph kept it to himself. You do realize that this ball could be any color, and I could have instructed Ralph to tell you the wrong color. Or maybe Ralph doesn't know his colors, despite what Caleb says. Or maybe he's just mistaken, or maybe he's dishonest. How many of you are certain that it's a yellow ball? Okay. Many of you are. And the reason is you trust Ralph. Because Ralph's given you his testimony about the color of this ball. Ralph says it's yellow, and you believe that Ralph will tell the truth. And just so that I don't cast any aspersions on Ralph, it is a yellow ball. That is yellow, right? I have trouble with yellow and orange. But that's yellow. I got this ball out this morning and put it in the box, and Ajax saw it and went crazy. And I had to try to convince him it was just a sermon illustration, that we weren't going out to play. He was not a happy camper. So here's my point. If you see that blue ball for yourself, that's knowledge, because you don't have to depend on indirect evidence. You've got empirical direct evidence for yourself. But when you talk about the color of this ball, until I showed it to you, you had to depend on Ralph's testimony. That's indirect evidence. That's faith, not knowledge. Until you see the ball for yourself. Now you know it's yellow. Now, some of you said, well, I'm certain that it's yellow.
You're certain because you have placed a high level of credibility on Ralph's testimony. You believe his integrity is good, and that's why I picked Ralph, incidentally, because I think that's the way he's considered. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, what I want to suggest to you that really, just about everything we understand about human history prior to our own empirical experience is based on faith. You realize that? Anybody here believe Abraham Lincoln lived? Now, outside of Tim, how many of you met Abraham Lincoln? How many of you saw him in the flesh? Someone says, well, I saw a picture of him. And how did you know that's Abraham? Because somebody else testified to his identity, right? Now someone says, yeah, but it's obvious. No, it's not. You just have lots of witnesses. And so with so many witnesses, we just say, well, that's got to be Abraham Lincoln. But you know what? I've never spoken to him. I've never seen him. I never shook his hand. Never went to his house and ate dinner. I never had any kind of empirical experience with Abraham Lincoln. I'm trusting the testimony of historians. And that's how we really accept all of human history, outside of biblical history I'm speaking of. And even there, we're accepting testimony. Do you see that? Someone says, well, I don't believe in this business of faith. Yes, you do. That's how you know there was a civil war, because you didn't participate in it and you didn't see it. Same thing with every other event before my lifetime. I accept them on the basis of the testimony of others. And some of it, because there's so much testimony, because of the credibility of the witnesses, I would say, I'm certain that happened, but it's still a matter of faith, not knowledge. That's important. Because sometimes I think what people want in order to assuage their doubts is they want knowledge. When all that's going to be available to them is faith. Well, secondly, sometimes people feel that if they ask questions, if they have some sort of doubts, or if they ask for evidence, that somehow they're being unfaithful. And that's not true. I said earlier that young people who go to college without a foundation, an evidential foundation for their faith, they run the risk of having something that will break up when it's assaulted by atheistic influences. Well, truth doesn't fear anything upon examination. The truth will stand on its own. And so we need to be willing to ask questions. And when our young people, or others for that matter, ask questions, questions deserve answers. Not this, I'm surprised that you would have that kind of a question. What I want to do is fortify your foundation if you have a question by giving you a reason for the faith that you hold. In the third place, we've been talking about evidence, and I'm talking about indirect evidence now, testimony of others. But evidence needs to be evaluated. Since we're often accepting the testimony of others, just like you accepted the testimony of Ralph, we need to be aware of biases. I think we all have certain biases, but that doesn't necessarily result in inaccurate testimony. The fact that I would be determined to tell you the truth should set aside all of my biases, whether I like the truth or not. But unfortunately, we know that not everybody has that conviction. We need to acknowledge that there are a lot of people in the world who are willing to give false testimony to swing the opinions of others to their desired position. And if you haven't figured that out, you're not paying attention to politics. Because that's really the name of the game. So much dishonesty with the hope that people won't look at the evidence, test the testimony to see if it's really true or not. Now, I'm not talking about politics primarily. I'm talking about
biblical conviction, faith. Faith in God, faith in the Bible. But evidence needs to be evaluated, because there are lots of people who are saying, well, now the evidence shows that there isn't a God, or that the Bible isn't inspired. What evidence are you looking at? You know, if you only drink water that has a high sulfur content in it, and that's all you've ever drunk, you may be convinced that that's the taste of all water, because that's your experience. But that's not the truth, is it? So what happens sometimes is when people listen only to skeptics, what happens is they likely become skeptics. That's all they know. Their source of testimony is tainted, if you'll let me continue the water illustration. We need to beware when we're evaluating evidence of appeals to authority. Do you know what I mean by that? I mean that sometimes people expect their testimony, their opinion, to be accepted simply because they are, quote, educated in some particular field, or because they have, generically speaking, a high level of scholastic education. Do you think that removes biases? You think that if a person has a PhD, that for some reason that means they always tell the truth? The last thing they do before they give you a PhD is they inject you with a hormone that makes you only tell the truth. Have you ever heard that? Because it's not true. Fact of the matter is, just because somebody has a lot of education doesn't necessarily mean they're telling the truth about things. Now, it may be that it's not a question of poor motivation. It just may be that their skill or their knowledge is inadequate. I've known prison company accepted. I've known some PhDs that I wasn't quite sure they could think themselves out of a wet paper bag in terms of their ability to reason. Well, what happens when the blind lead the blind? Well, Jesus talked about that. Do you remember in Matthew 15 when Jesus had some rather stern things to say to the Pharisees who were critical of his disciples? And the disciples were kind of a little bit aghast at what Jesus had said, and Jesus just said, hey, leave them alone. If the blind lead the blind, they'll both fall into the pit. What happens if we follow the blind? If we blindly follow the blind, we're going to fall into the same pit that they're going to fall into. You know, a good illustration of that, and I'll just very briefly point this out. In 1 Kings 13, there was a prophet who was sent to King Jeroboam in the north, in the northern kingdom of Israel, to the city of Bethel. Jeroboam had set up idolatrous worship there. And the prophet comes to him and opposes him, preaches against his idolatry. Jeroboam offers hospitality to this individual, but the prophet says, I was told by God not to eat or drink in this place and to go back home by a different route. Well, apparently the sons of another old prophet heard this conversation or heard about it. They went home and told their father, and their father sent and summoned this guy to his house. I also am a prophet, as you are. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you into your house that he may eat bread and drink water. Now, that's the opposite of what God had said. And then the rest of the verse said, but he lied to him. Well, maybe you remember the story. The prophet who'd been sent by God to oppose Jeroboam is convinced that this other prophet is telling the truth. And so he goes home and eats with him. And while he's there, God gives a message through the old prophet and says, you're going to die. You're not going to go back to the tombs of your fathers. And sure enough, on his way home, a lion comes and kills him. If the blind lead the blind, both will fall into the pit. So we need to be careful that we're not following blindly those who are in fact blind when it comes to their testimony. And then finally, there needs to be a willingness to accept answers. I want to give you an illustration of this from some material that was recently studied in the Life of Christ class when we were talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You may recall that the disciples didn't immediately accept the testimony of the witnesses who had seen Jesus resurrected. For instance, there were two disciples on the way to Emmaus, and I want you to listen to what is said, what they say to Jesus as they're walking along and Jesus has joined them. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. Now listen to what Jesus says to them. Oh, foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Why didn't you listen? They were getting testimony from Mary Magdalene and others about the resurrection of Jesus. The rest of the apostles, when they met together, if you look in Mark 16, verses 9 through 14, but when they heard that he was alive, my iPad just decided to die, but fortunately I came prepared. Verse 9. Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. So she's giving testimony. Jesus has been raised from the dead. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. So they've got the answer to the question. They've got the testimony, but they're not interested in accepting the answer. Don't believe it. After these things, he appeared in another form to two of them. We just looked at that in Luke 24. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them. So the apostles have gotten testimony from here and testimony from there, but they won't accept the answers to the question, what happened to Jesus? Afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at table, and he rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. Jesus rebuked them because they were unwilling to accept the testimony of those who actually had the evidence, direct evidence. All of these individuals that we've looked at, and we could include Thomas, among those. Thomas was the one who wasn't with the apostles originally, and then later on joined them, and his statement to them originally was, unless I see in his hands the marks of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. Jesus provides him with evidence, direct evidence. Here, put your hand here. Then here's what Jesus says in the end. Have you believed because you've seen me? He's asking Thomas. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Why do you believe that Jesus was raised from the dead? You didn't see it. You weren't there. He hasn't appeared to you, hasn't appeared to me. I believe the testimony of witnesses. And that, of course, depends on how credible I think those witnesses are. Well, let me conclude this morning by simply saying it's not a bad thing to ask questions about our beliefs. In fact, the end result may be that our faith becomes stronger, not weaker, because we find more evidence, more reason to believe what we have believed, to shore up our convictions. But I want to tell you, we need to base our faith on evidence, not on tradition, not on wishful thinking. We need to evaluate evidence, often in the form of human testimony, usually. An apple tree naturally bears apples, not pears. Skeptics produce skepticism. We need to evaluate the testimony, the evidence. If we ask questions, though, we need to be willing to accept legitimate evidence. Otherwise, there's no real reason to ask a question if you're not going to accept a reasonable answer. And then finally, don't be afraid to ask older, experienced Christians about your doubts. A lot of times what happens is because people are afraid that others will think less of them because they have some sort of doubt, they keep it to themselves. And they struggle with themselves, and the devil loves it.
Because if he can keep you by yourself, then you don't have the benefit of the strength, the experience, the maturity, the knowledge of others who could help you. Don't be afraid to ask others. In many cases, they've traveled the same road. They may have had the same doubts and can share with you how it is that their faith was solidified, was strengthened. Well, I want to go back to Asaph. And I want you to see that in verse 17, he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. I was almost to fall, to slip. And then I got the big picture. I got the answer I was looking for. Asaph stayed with God because he was willing to accept the answer that he got. He asked the question, what about the wicked who prosper? And he accepted the answer that God offered. My study this morning wasn't really designed to confirm the truth of the Gospels. We could do that if you'd like. I've already run over time, but that really wasn't the point this morning. Rather, my objective was to suggest to you that we need to accept evidence, evaluate evidence, and then accept it if it's valid. And the gospel writers claimed guidance by the Holy Spirit. And what they wrote is that Jesus is the Son of God, risen from the dead, the miracle of miracles, declared by the Holy Spirit to be the Son of God. Romans 1 and verse 4. And that truth is at the crux, at the foundation of our salvation. As Jesus said, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. And so we accept that truth and then we respond to it. And if you need to respond to the gospel, to become a Christian, to enter the kingdom that the relationship, kingdom relationship that Douglas talked about earlier, and we want to encourage you to obey the gospel at your earliest opportunity, and we will assist you if that's your desire at any time that you make that decision. Thank you for your consideration this morning.